Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner joining you with the third program in the series History Under Siege, a survey of debates and tensions about the past around the world. Today we're on home turf in Australia, which in the last decade or so has seen an unprecedented focus on history, from front page headlines in the broadsheets to media shock jocks, and as politicians of all hues, from Prime Ministers Gough Whitlam to John Howard, have ignited and inflamed the history wars in order to cement their own view of Australia's national story. History Under Siege in Australia.
For Charles III, this day was a day of hope. First they saw oyster shells upon the banks. Then they met an old aborigine. The old man pointed due south, describing the roaring of the sea and the height of the wave.
I believe that the balance sheet of Australian history is overwhelmingly a positive one.
The starting point might be to recognise that the problem starts with us, the non-Aboriginal Australians. It was we who did the dispossessing.
When I was brought up, we were perhaps too kind to Australian history, and I call that the three cheers view of Australian history. In universities, that was increasingly replaced by a view which I called, I made up the phrase, the black armband
view of our past reflects a belief that most Australian history since 1788 has been little more than a disgraceful story of imperialism, exploitation, racism, sexism, and other forms of discrimination.
We fail to make the most basic human response.
The Prime Minister, I think, really engaging in another battle in the history wars.
The Prime Minister assured tonight's audience his party was as committed as ever to fighting the history wars.
The past decade or so in Australia has seen a dramatic escalation in debates and divisions over history. It seems that daily Australian history has been called upon, fought over, or invoked to justify contemporary policies and positions by politicians. So, in order to try and understand the wellspring for this increasingly intense focus on the past, it's necessary to look backwards to the origins of Australian historiography itself. And Stuart McIntyre from the School of History at Melbourne University has been doing just that. He and fellow historian Rob Pascoe have been researching the work of historians who entered the Australian Academy of Social Sciences after it was set up in the early 1940s. And they've found that the discipline of Australian history, as we know it today, is a relatively recent development.
After the Second World War, there's a considerable investment in higher education and research. It's when the university system expands, again because of a belief that this sort of research and expertise can improve prosperity and social life, and the humanities can enrich civic life. And Australians for the first time had their own research capacity in fields such as history.
In the history schools, the various universities in Australia before 1939, most of the professors were Englishmen who saw the history of Australia as a branch of British colonial history, the beneficent influence of the British in the world as colonisers and empire builders.
In Charles Sturt's words, the old man pointed due south. It was evident this old man had been upon the coast, and we were therefore highly delighted at the prospect then held out to us of reaching it. A day of hope for Charles Sturt. Would that he could see the barren land that he explored, made green and fertile as it is today.
From the 1951 ABC radio documentary, which featured a reenactment of Charles Sturt's 19th century expedition into the centre of Australia in search of an imagined inland sea. That the subject of this documentary featured the epic journey of a colonial explorer reveals a great deal about how Australian history was perceived in the 1950s. Stuart McIntyre again.
I think if you go back in the 50s and 60s, you would find it difficult to discover public discussion of history along political lines. One of the things that strikes you if you go back and have a look at 1951, which was the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the Commonwealth, the commemoration program was pretty small and had almost no historical content. Furthermore, Robert Menzies didn't want it to have historical content. It's rather odd for someone who'd studied history as an undergraduate at university. So that it doesn't very often get taken up by politicians. I think it starts to get taken up by politicians in the 1970s. Manning Clark's an important figure there.
Identity Cut 3 is from the 21st of May, 85. It's an interview with Australian historian Professor Manning Clark.
I'm sorry that I didn't start at a time when it would have been possible to have done more justice to the Aborigines. I think that there's a lot more about the Aborigines in those volumes than there had been in previous volumes of Australian history. And that for a very special reason. I had actually had the good fortune when I was a boy to meet an Aboriginal preacher called David Unipon. And he drew my attention to things that I had never heard of before.
Manning Clark's History of Australia, I think, had a considerable impact on Gough Whitlam and others of that generation, who saw it as suggesting that Australian culture had a depth. It coincided with the renaissance of Australian theatre and film and Australian themes in art. And Manning Clark was seen as suggesting what Australia might be. And that would lead to a conservative antagonism to him, especially when he became prominently involved in the argument over the dismissal.
The arrival by sea of the people who have made up the great waves of immigration to these shores, from the convicts to the boat people.
There were probably about 20 historians working in universities in Australia in 1939. There were 600 or 700 of them by the 1970s. So that's the high point, in fact, of the history profession and for a number of the professions in the humanities and social sciences.
I hope Australia Remembers will add to our nation's understanding and confidence about our place in the world.
An unarmed man.
And our capacity to play a creative
with a donkey
and humane part in it.
Who, over some 40 days, rescued a number of injured and wounded men.
Born of the Australians who had endured World War I and the Great Depression, they fought a war in defence of the country they loved, and they bequeathed to their children the opportunities which they themselves had been denied. They were nation builders, and our freedom was their legacy.
Of what Simpson and his donkey represents, then we will lose our direction as a country.
I mean, our starting point in this study is to imagine that history is an incredibly important staple diet for politicians whose task it is to persuade people. If you want to establish legitimacy and authority for your arguments, history is extremely valuable. We think that history is deployed often, whether it be talking about turning points, whether it be talking about doing things new, establishing a break with the past. These are all invoking history.
Historian David Lowe from Deakin University, who's been looking at the ways in which Australian politicians have used and very possibly abused history since Federation. Lowe argues that an analysis of the use of the past by politicians in their speeches and public rhetoric will help reveal the central role that history plays in contemporary society, that constant dance between the past and the present. David Lowe thinks that it will also aid the task, as articulated by one politician, former Prime Minister John Howard, of demonstrating the significance of history for an informed citizenry. So is it possible to look to the prose of our politicians and see the influences of that body of Australian historiography, which began to emerge in universities in the 1960s and 70s?
In terms of the great influences on politicians and influences taking the shape of those who write great history, then yes, Australian historiography comes into its own probably from the 70s onwards, realistically. And yes, you can see this. I noticed that one of Kevin Rudd's first comments about when he was casting an eye over Australian foreign policy, before he became Prime Minister, he was drawing on the work of a fairly radical Greg Pemberton, who wrote about how Australia got involved in Vietnam by a view which was very critical of conservative governments. And you can find, I think, works of Australian history being wielded in Parliament quite commonly from 1980s onwards. So I suppose the Australian writing, the canon, comes into its own more from that point onwards. Before that, if my research suggests a few things, it is that they're very beholden still to great works by British historians, including Winston Churchill, seems to have been drawn on by dozens of politicians, in the 50s in particular, but also the classics of Toynbee, Gibbon, Empires Rising and Falling, this kind of stuff, and huge biographical works. These are the ones that seem to be the staple diet of politicians until we get into that 70 zone, as far as I can see. But I agree with you, in more recent times, it's become interesting as to which historians are drawn on, and I suppose there's been an increasingly polarised view of who you go to.
The current Prime Minister must be one of the few leaders from any era in any nation who appears to have so little respect for his own country's history that he is attempting to rewrite it.
I tell you, I learned one thing. I learned about self-regard for Australia. Yeah. Not about some cultural cringe to a country which decided not to defend the Malaysian Peninsula, not to worry about Singapore, not to give us our troops back to keep ourselves free from Japanese domination. This was the country that you people wedded yourself to. And even as they walked out on you and joined the common market, you were still looking for your MBEs and your knighthoods and all the rest of the regalia that come with it. You would take Australia right back down the time tunnel to the cultural cringe where you've always come from. The same old fogyism of the 1950s. We won't have a bar of it. You can go back to your 50s, to your nostalgia, to your Menzies, the Caseys and the whole lot. They were not aggressively Australian. They were not aggressively proud of our culture. And we'll have no bar of you or your sterile ideology.
The key issue for Keating, I think, is he understood how to connect history with symbolic acts, such as kissing the ground when he landed in New Guinea, that kind of thing he was very good at.
I mean, Labor politicians are more inclined to retire and write a memoir. That kind of memoir activity did buttress what was a fair appropriation going on about how Labor's writing of Australia's history, often a story of thwarted nationalism, of trying to you know, actually break free of a British embrace, if you like. That story was able to progress far further because of this tendency in who wrote what. By contrast, conservative politicians would retire and join various boards and not have time to write their memoirs.
87 years ago, General Bird would continue to write, "I shall always regard my time as a comrade of the brave and strong men from Australia and New Zealand. Today, our nation says farewell to the last of those brave and strong men." An essence that continues to define our nation's identity and the standards by which we judge ourselves.
Again, maybe let me just talk a little bit about a more prosaic story. Australia's victory, Australia's involvement in victory in World War II, was effectively appropriated by the Labor Party. They won the war. And if you look at the behaviour of Liberals in the 1950s and 1960s, they are recurringly tearing their hair out for not being able to own any part of that victory, even though they were in power for about half of the war. And they think they did some pretty good things before John Curtin came in. But they were so effectively written out by the way in which Labor historiography geared up very effectively, accompanied by memoirs and so on, that there is this sense of unfinished business about how to talk about wars. Mm. I think some of that fed into John Howard's thinking, but he found it much easier to leapfrog over World War II back to World War I, which is probably more fertile ground and probably not so appropriated in terms of who did what.
Teach Australian values or clear off. That's the message to Islamic schools in Australia from the Federal Education Minister Brendan Nelson.
Dr. Nelson gives the World War I story of Simpson and his donkey as an example of the values he needs.
It's about an unarmed man with a donkey who, over some 40 days, rescued a number of injured and wounded men. He was unarmed with a donkey, and he represents everything that's at the heart of what it means to be an Australian.
We have to draw a distinction, I think, between the way in which the past is used as a political resource and the study of the past. Clearly, prime ministers and politicians will use historical events as markers with particular sort of resonance. I don't know, when Paul Keating talked about the fall of Singapore, for him it symbolised the need for a more assertive nationalism. When John Howard talks about Anzac, he talks about a young country going to war on the other side of the world because its fortunes are at stake as part of the British Empire. I think that it's a sort of a mistake to think that, historians should criticise that sort of usage, but I think one of their roles is to pay attention to it, to ask questions about it, to suggest that there are other ways of understanding the event.
What use is history?
I still think it's useful as supplementing the observations of people on what happens to human society, in human society, or if you like to go a bit further, of what human beings are like. I mean, there are only two sources on what they're like. One is to observe in the present, and the other is to know about how they behave in the past.
I think that the understanding of Australian history that developed in the 1960s and 70s was one that saw Australia, in a sense, coming of age and progressing to independent nationhood. It celebrated lines of public activity from the convicts through to diggers onto the goldfield. It esteemed traditions of egalitarianism and mateship. That understanding of Australian history would be contested by the new right and commentators from the 1980s onwards.
Stuart McIntyre. And according to his co-researcher, Rob Pascoe, the main challenge to those accepted views of Australia's past, forged over 30 years ago, came from a strange and unexpected quarter, economics. It was the shift in economic philosophy in the 1980s which would ultimately provide the tools for the culture warriors and those who mounted the first assaults in the history wars, both in Australia and in other countries. And for Rob Pascoe, whose own study of those inside the Australian Academy of Social Sciences includes economists, the seismic turn undertaken inside that discipline is rich in historical irony.
One thing that struck us as a paradox in this study is that when we began thinking about post-war Australia, the economists began as the heroes, people like Nugget Coombs, really fundamentally improved Australian society. They were involved in the reconstruction of Australia after the horrors of the Pacific War. They really did us a huge favour as a nation, and they really are responsible for a lot of the country's, you know, enduring and valuable institutions. Then sometime in the 1980s, economists suddenly started to produce a different kind of idea of Australia. Australia as a society where it was reasonable to maximise one's individual worth and position. Mm-hmm. Neoliberal or economic rationalism came to be the dominant force. And so economics changes from being a discipline that's concerned with full employment, with nation-building questions, to being a discipline that's concerned with how the individual might do well in given situations. And so no matter what the issue was, an economic position was suddenly became the key one. And in history, as a discipline, this had many powerful and useful benefits. For example, it helped us think about the way in which convict society might have been constituted by different social groups than the ones we thought about, that convicts might simply not have been victims of an oppressive regime. They might have actually been agents of their own making. There was a whole lot of ways in which it actually made sense. But at the end of the day, it led to a fundamental change in the way in which conservative history was being written, based around the individual needs and wants. And in that kind of context, what happens very quickly is that what I would call the real history, the longer term themes, the social conflicts, the class conflicts, all these issues suddenly disappear from view. And so what we're left with in the new right telling of our history is some really pretty wacko ideas. And it's because the new right is fundamentally ahistorical that there are so few leading, well-regarded new right historians. It's not as if we've sort of sluiced out all the conservatives and got rid of them all. It's rather that it'd be very hard to be a new right historian and to take history seriously as a discipline, because history as a discipline makes a whole lot of assumptions about the way in which societies work and seeks to weave patterns and order with interest in the individual, with characters, with agents of various kinds, and social groups. So those sorts of categories fall out of the new right agenda.
Well, the Herald Sun newspaper came out this morning with a front page exclusive, "I Wasn't Stolen."
It's one of the reasons why people have been so reluctant to come forward and question the stolen generation myth. This very, very loose, reckless, does the cause of abolition countless tens of millions of dollars. Stolen generation, stolen. You call that child stolen?
And as something of a counter to our concern with the ways in which liberals don't tell their own stories, conservative politicians are best served by well-funded think tanks in Australia, unlike the left, for example. And we do know that they have some commentators who are very strategically placed in major media.
The history wars were framed as an attack on the history profession by conservative commentators who, furthermore, I think had access to the mainstream media in an unprecedented way.
John Howard was 17 when Quadrant was first published 50 years ago. The magazine now claims it's the Prime Minister's favourite.
I'm finally succumbing to Peter Garrett's advice, and it's great to embrace an evening of culture and poetry and all of that.
Now safely in government, the Prime Minister assured tonight's audience his party was as committed as ever to fighting
the history. I do not take the black armband view of Australian history, which is so popular in some circles. I believe that the balance sheet of Australian history is overwhelmingly a positive one. Heroic achievements, remarkably enlightened, tolerant and diverse Australian community.
When I was brought up, we were perhaps too kind to Australian history, and I call that the three cheers view of Australian history. But in universities, that was increasingly replaced by a view which I called, I made up the phrase, the black armband view of history, where people believed that Australian history, in effect, was negative. And my view was that both were extreme positions, and I thought the black armband view was as extreme as the three cheers view once was. And you often give these speeches and nobody takes much notice of them, and nobody ever used the black armband phrase. And then suddenly Mr Howard, after he came to power, he said that we were too much influenced by the black armband view of history.
Geoffrey Blainey is one of Australia's leading historians and is also known for his perceived affiliation with those of a conservative, sometimes called New Right, persuasion. In Rob Pascoe and Stuart McIntyre's study of the scholars admitted to the Academy of Social Sciences, they suggest that Geoff Blainey might well be the sole living representative of a so-called New Right position.
What we do in our study is, because we both have a very high opinion of Geoff Blainey, is that we differentiate between the young Blainey and the old Blainey. The young Blainey, in fact, is the author of many fine works which established a number of key themes which are now orthodoxy. One of them is that we were once British and are no longer British. Our Britishness slipped away from us as we became an independent nation sometime about the 1940s. Secondly, that we did dispossess the Aborigines, and he wrote brilliant stuff around Aboriginal culture and life. And thirdly, is the fundamental proposition that we've been multicultural is also really clear in the young Blainey. And in fact, Geoff Blainey has been drawn into the history wars really unwittingly, and of course beginning with his famous speech at Warrnambool in 1984. But it's more what Blainey is said to say rather than what Blainey actually says that's important. And both sides of that debate in the 1980s characterised Blainey in ways that were useful to their positions rather than what Blainey really says in his works. So Blainey comes through this as a fine historian who does understand a lot about Australian life and does understand some of the nuances of our history. And yet, he's drawn upon by conservative and New Right politicians.
Injustices were done in Australia and no one should obscure or minimise them. The debate over Australian history, however, risks being distorted if its focus is confined only to the shortcomings of previous generations.
I think Mabo illustrated, a fundamental flaw in our legal system, and the basic story about the nation was changed, so people had to make very significant adjustments in the way they thought about our past and the way they envisaged the law. So it was demanding, I think, a lot of Australians to make that change.
First of all, I think we need to note that historians have been public commentators on important historical events. I mean, take Henry Reynolds, for example, who played a quite important role in, I think, awakening Australians to dimensions of the colonial past that had not been widely recognised. I think what happened is that as a result of conservative anxiety about such matters, a series of criticisms, or waves of criticisms, built up. I mean, one of them prominently was over the bicentenary and whether the bicentenary should be a celebration or whether it should be an occasion for reflection and how you should strike the balance. The interesting thing about that, I think, is that the criticism is of the historians who are immediately accused of a lack of patriotism or of belittling the country. They're treated as if there is complete uniformity amongst them. You could walk down the corridor of a history department and you wouldn't find any differences at all. And there's a sort of an objection that these are people who are out of touch with how ordinary Australians feel and are telling us how we ought to feel. The criticisms are made from the outside. I mean, from time to time, when conservatives got cross with Manning Clark, they would ring around history departments trying to find someone who would join in the criticism, and encountered a reluctance. They confused the reluctance with agreement. Historians didn't agree with Manning Clark. They just saw no reason why they should join in that sort of witch hunt.
Current editor Paddy McGuinness also deserves our special praise for the way he has carried on the quadrant tradition of fine scholarship with a sceptical, questioning eye for cant, hypocrisy and moral vanity.
And what we found extraordinary reading through the main New Right publication, which is the journal Quadrant, is in fact how thin on the ground the New Right history is. It's actually, New Right history is history that's spoken not by the intellectuals and the writers and the professionals and the academics. It's rather, it's written by the journalists, the media commentators, the people who work in think tanks, and the politicians. And that's, they're the people who try to set the New Right agenda and try to drum up a different version of our past. And it's because they don't have a history training of the sort that we would sort of see as normal and legitimate, then their history is very, very shallow indeed.
Despite a more diverse and lively intellectual environment in Australia compared with past decades, we should not underestimate the degree to which the soft left still holds sway, even dominance, especially in Australia's universities.
John Howard didn't make a great deal of these matters in the lead-up to the election, but if you recall, he was presenting a very small target at the time. But he did announce shortly after he was elected that he objected strongly to the way that Paul Keating had used history and the way in which implied the historical profession collaborated with it. He had a particular animus against Manning Clark. And from then on, it was a sort of one of the strategies that he and the government would return to from time to time. Kicked along, of course, by the way in which it interfered in cultural institutions, most notably the National Museum, where in a quite extraordinary fashion it overrode the professional curators to insist that certain exhibitions had to be reworked.
Our culture has become more politicised. Now, you can point to that in many different areas. You can point to the politicisation of the public service. You can point to the debates around the National Museum. You can point to the ABC. You can point to history in schools. You can point to the citizenship debate. All of those areas, you can find evidence, very, very strong evidence, to suggest that the government over the last decade has not only been trying to foster certain debates, it's been trying to direct the outcome or the content of those debates.
Historian Mark McKenna.
Just under 2 weeks ago, I spoke at the opening of a memorial in Sydney to the men who died in what was surely amongst the worst episodes in our history, the death by torture, execution and disease of nearly 2,000 Australians at Sandaken in Borneo. No Australian would for a moment question the propriety and historic justice in the erection of the Sandaken Memorial. Yet there are people who will say that the memory of death by massacre, torture and disease, when it was inflicted on Aboriginal Australians, should be expunged. That to pay tribute to their memory is an exercise in guilt. That one memory is legitimate, the other the product of a guilt industry.
The current debate over Australian history would benefit from a more balanced approach, from a wider perspective, and from less preordained pessimism.
Well, I don't think we can be so selective. I say we must pay tribute to the good and the bad in our history, and that when we honestly do that, when we are not held up, but given the strength to make progress, we make it.
Which the soft left still holds sway, even dominance, especially in Australia's universities.
Was that the High Court recognised Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, Indigenous Australians, as property owners in their own right, not as people who had got property as a gift from guilt-ridden legislators. Conservatives who have always upheld the rule of law and above all have defended the rights of property were unable to make the conceptual leap to realise that Indigenous people now under the common law were property owners.
I think it's remarkable that over the past 30 or 40 years there has been a transformation in the way in which most Australians feel about that past, but things such as Mabo and WIC have been fundamentally disturbing of older conservative views.
Keith Winchtuttle is the author of The Fabrication of Aboriginal History, Volume 1, and he's written an article in the latest issue of Quadrant magazine about the critical response he's received. And what did the leaders of the history profession do, the deans, the professors? Did any of them praise your book?
None of them have praised the book. Stuart McIntyre, who's the sort of godfather of Australian history, the dean of Melbourne History School, he said, I'm persuaded that some of Winchtuttle's charges are true. He's never said which charges. And, of course, if some of them are true, then the logical thing is to ask is what interpretation should be changed. I mean, the history profession has really kind of closed ranks and is not accepting the sort of charges I've made, even though they can't refute them. In fact, what the attacks on my book have done have really confirmed that there's no credible evidence that there's large-scale killings of Aborigines in Tasmania by whites.
I think it's true to say that if you look at a number of the neoconservatives, they come from left-wing backgrounds where there is a sort of a fervour about their youthful politics that is simply, you know, 180 degrees reversal. And they find it very hard to accept that there can be legitimate disagreement, so that your opponent is unworthy and has to be discredited. I mean, one of the features, I think, of the history wars that anybody who's been drawn into it appreciates is that the way in which you might want to argue a position and to consider the alternatives and to suggest where the evidence leads is very badly suited to the language and the conventions of exchanges in the history wars. I mean, there's a sort of an insistence there and a refusal to concede a point that is, I think, inimical to the whole enterprise of historical understanding.
Historical realism, the sort of perspective that I follow, that you investigate your facts and then you deduce your conclusions from the facts, that's kind of passé, and that instead of documentary evidence, we can now use Aboriginal myths and legends, and we've now got historians who argue these particular ideas should be regarded as kind of symbolic of Aboriginal and white relations, and therefore they are the authentic voice of history, that people can make up myths, they can massage the truth in any way you like. There's no checks on its veracity. There's no way you can have a dispute over myths. You can't prove one is right and one is wrong, or you can't, you know, dispute the details in them. It just means that you give history away completely. That, you know, people can decide the truth among themselves. A collective of historians who want to agree on a particular point come to a consensus, and therefore that is the truth. Well, that's not the truth. The truth is what the evidence shows.
My concern with Keith Winchtuttle's work is that it is actually poor history. It's not only that it's wrong, but it's poor history. It's forensic in the extreme. It doesn't have the gravitas. It doesn't have the sense of compassion for the people about whom he's writing. It fails a whole series of basic tests that we apply to history essays and history writing in this country.
We look back with pride and gratitude on what has happened. We reflect upon the astonishing artistic achievement of Australians. We reflect, of course, on the astonishing sporting achievements of the men and women of Australia who represent us on the sporting fields with such great distinction.
And if you look at what, in terms of the policy of the Howard government over the last decade, the culture wars were not abstract theoretical debates. They were there, visible. very, very visible on the ground in terms of the policy implemented through those various institutions, the appointments to various boards and committees, the government policy on Anzac Day, the funding of cash prizes for Anzac Day activities in schools, and so on and so on. I mean, citizenship, education debates. This culture war infiltrated every aspect of our political, cultural policy. It's not abstract.
There is a school of history which ignores or trivialises all those parts of the past which can't be conscripted into glorifying a politically correct version of the present.
And it's also cruel to rob a generation of Australian children, to steal from them a pride in their past that they can rightly feel.
But there is a tendency which I've referred to as minority fundamentalism.
Then you degenerate into the whole postmodernist worldview that, that, you know, people can decide the truth among themselves.
Many of the ploys that have been used in Australia's culture wars and history wars have been adopted from American neoconservatives. The whole idea of elites, of the chattering classes, the attack on political correctness, all of those terms and ways of framing the argument are taken from American neoconservatives.
The standards got thrown up in the air like a piece of red meat to be yipped at and yowled at by the various dogs in the culture wars. So it became a media storm. It was quite remarkable, something that those of us who'd worked on these pretty carefully over 3 years were taken aback at. We I think, ran into a buzzsaw. That's how we saw it.
American historian Gary B. Nash, one of the authors of a set of national guidelines for the teaching of history in the United States. In late 1994, when this voluntary teaching guide was released, he and his two co-authors found themselves at the centre of a major furor after neoconservatives were outraged at the language and historical interpretation in the teaching guide. Leading the charge was one Lynn Cheney, former chairwoman of the powerful funding body, the National Endowment for the Humanities, who said that the standards presented a grim and gloomy portrayal of American history.
There are a wide range of people who each for their own reason came together in a repudiation of bourgeois middle American values. I think that I represent the reassertion of American exceptionalism. A nation that has said, okay, we've listened to all this junk, where you're supposed to know who your grandmother was, and that gets you extra points on the test. You know, this is a dangerous, racist, sexist country. Now, I can find you quote after quote and group after group across this country who said that.
Former U.S. Congressman Newt Gingrich, who, among other neocons, kept up a sustained attack on the U.S. national history standards. A committee of review was established, and after some minor reworking, the standards were finally released. And while some U.S. states chose to write their own, the national history standards ultimately had widespread take-up among history teachers in the U.S. So what was it about the tenor and tone of the standards which led to such outrage from conservatives in the U.S.? Gary B. Nash.
Well, there's no doubt, Michelle, that the approach of the teachers and the professional historians was that of those who feel that critical thinking is the key to an intelligent citizenry, and that it was much more important to be able to think about cause and effect or multiple perspectives on the past than to remember an exact date or name or place or event. Those on the right, conservatives generally, wanted a nuts and bolts history where they believed everything was largely agreed upon, and that the notion of interpreting history from different perspectives was offensive to them. The word revisionism, historical revisionism, that phrase was thrown about as a kind of sneering curse phrase. So revisionism itself became something under attack. Historical scholarship, the idea that historians should disagree and debate, that became an offensive, at least that was seemed to be a marketable argument.
Too often history has fallen victim in an ever more crowded curriculum to subjects deemed more relevant to today. Too often it is taught without any sense of structured narrative, replaced by a fragmented stew of themes and issues.
Early in 2006, then Prime Minister John Howard used his Australia Day speech to launch his own assault on the teaching of Australian history in schools. He called for root and branch renewal, for the return to narrative and chronology, and soon his Education Minister, Julie Bishop, was warning that history teaching was in danger of being manipulated by political agendas. By August of that year, the government had hosted a history summit which brought together 23 historians, educators and public commentators. Within a year of the summit, a set of recommendations for the teaching of history had been written, apparently then ditched and rewritten. And the original steering group, which had gathered at the summit, had been reduced to a four-person reference group, two of whom were historians, one being Geoffrey Blainey. There was also a teaching guide for years 9 and 10, which begins with Indigenous Australia's early encounters with Europeans and ends with the 2000 Olympics in Sydney.
When the History Summit was taken up, I think that we hoped that there would be agreement. Yes, the History Summit had a skewed membership. There were a number of conservatives who seemed to be there principally because they were conservatives, but there were a number of highly reputable historians and people who meant well for history. Yes, someone who'd played a role in the history wars was commissioned to write one of the papers and made recommendations for a curriculum that wasn't so much, I think, ideological as inappropriate and overambitious. But the summit agreed that it was possible to work out an approach on which there would be broad agreement. And that was then done. The difficulty was that the Prime Minister didn't like it and said he wouldn't accept it. So that, and furthermore, throughout this period, you had the persistent attacks on the teaching profession by the minister and on occasion by the Prime Minister. So the opportunities, I think, were frittered away in a series of sort of partisan and unnecessary attempts to make mileage out of it.
It was refreshing to have a government want to have a summit about history. That was remarkably brave for Howard. He was a Prime Minister who actually took history seriously. And we would also agree with him that it's important for historians to insert into their versions of the past real people, real characters, real agents of social change and social history. But what they don't and can't ever agree is exactly which characters, which events, which processes will always be important to us.
And I believe that it will provide a comprehensive set of signposts, milestones for the teaching of Australian history.
I think the difficulty about well-meaning people who want to suggest that, you know, people should be taught the facts is that they confuse memorisation of historical data with historical understanding. And clearly historical understanding requires knowledge, but the knowledge comes from the engagement with the subject and the attempt to interpret it and understand it. You're much more likely to know that Edmund Barton was the first Prime Minister if you've really got interested in the making of the Commonwealth than if you're told you have to memorise it.
We start off with Federation and move through the wars, the Depression, to basically now. And so the wars are pretty interesting. They're quite good, but the Federation, you do often end up falling asleep and it's quite boring.
It's just more interesting. It has more to do with the rest of the world and how Australia fits in with it.
Well, yeah, it's good to know about where you're from, but when Australia doesn't have much of a history, you know, there's not much to learn.
When you look at all the other countries and all the other history they have, it's far more interesting. You've got Rome, you've got samurai, you know, you've got civil wars. But Australia, you've got Federation.
Actually, people in our class don't like it that much. I'm like one of the only people that do, but I think that it is important to learn about your country's history.
There's a lot of note-taking, which can get a bit tedious. But the wars are good. So more war in Australian history would be good.
You know, there are many reasons beyond simply nationalism that makes military history interesting. It's also its international component, where Australia's actually out there in the world for the, you know, some of the only times in Australian history. And kids are really fascinated with a kind of global context like that.
That's historian Anna Clark, who's collected 250 interviews with school students, teachers and education professionals about their attitudes to Australian history. Her book, History's Children, has just been released, and it offers a real insight into why and how school students might end up loving or loathing Australian history. And she has some doubts as well about the new guide for the teaching of history in years 9 and 10.
The students that I talked with, and the teachers as well, but you know, particularly the students, it might have turned them off history even more, because the last thing they want is to be writing down endless facts and dates and rote learning and writing notes off the boards and looking at overheads. They want to do it. They want to debate, you know, the apology in class in a sensitive way, in a knowledgeable way, and knowing certain facts about it. But they do actually want to take part in these historical discussions, because history isn't just what happened. It's something that's around us all the time, and it's something we do, and it requires a number of skills. And if you're just filling up the lesson with content, you're never going to be able to learn those skills. Like, how do you deal with the fact that the Anzac legend has changed over time?
The spirit bequeathed by Alec and his generation, though born of war's adversity, still slumbers within our people, ready to rise and draw new breath when disaster strikes or danger threatens. An essence that continues to define our nation's identity.
I think one of the key dangers is that because Anzac is taking up increasing space in our national memory, if you like, that we have less space for the history of Aboriginal people. We have less space for our political history. We have less space for our democratic history. We buy the myth of 1915 at the expense, perhaps, of understanding many of the other ways in which Australia did truly become a nation.
Historian Mark McKenna, who last year wrote an essay about the use and abuse of the Anzac legend by politicians, most prominently former Prime Minister John Howard. McKenna argues that the Anzac legend was increasingly invoked by the Howard government after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and that this concentration on Australia's military history came at the expense of other aspects of the country's history, those which might not necessarily engender sentiments such as pride and patriotism.
If you look at Peter Costello's statements, if you look at Alexander Downer's statements, if you look at John Howard's statements, both in Iraq and in Australia, on talkback radio, especially all three of those, you know, leading politicians from the Howard era, you'll find that they explicitly say that what our boys are doing in Iraq is no different to what we were doing on the beaches of Anzac Cove in 1915. Now, that is an example, okay, on a very superficial level, it's an example of political exploitation and politicians trying to cash in on a national myth. Okay, that's not unusual. But it is very worrying from the point of view of its complete disregard for history. It's a complete disregard for the history of the event, which was very much rooted in an imperial campaign and was not about us. And that, I think, links into other questions that, for me, a lot of the new embrace of Anzac Day is an attempt, in a way, to inflate our image of ourselves on the back of the memory of the deaths of those men at Anzac Cove in 1915.
Our nation pledges itself once more to an ethos of selflessness and shared determination, courage and compassion. We signal our understanding that the freedom under which we shelter needs to be nurtured and at times defended anew. We think of the men and women of the Australian Defence Force now serving in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Then a lot of people didn't get it when Billy Hughes put on a slouch hat for the 1919 election. You can go a long way with that sort of military stance.
What it's about is elevating a myth to the level of an article of faith. And it's through that article of faith that we bond as a national community. So it's a way of providing national communion, if you like. Once it gets to that level, it's no longer really about a critical appraisal of the history. That gets completely lost.
John Howard, I think, did that very effectively, actually. I think his use of the Anzac legend to build bridges between what is a proud military tradition and a more vernacular form of Australianism, I think he did it extremely effectively. In his eulogy for the last World War I digger, Alec Campbell, I think in other instances of his speech-making around Anzac Day, his references to the war in Iraq, I think he actually did that extremely effectively, trod that path between telling a story of so-called Australianness, of all those kind of images of blinding loyalty to your mates, the digger image, if you like, and build a bridge between that and what contemporary mateship was all about. It's attracted criticism, including by historian commentators, but I must say I think he did it more effectively than some people would give him credit for.
It's got different aspects to it that I think are probably misunderstood if we think that it's a glorification of war. When I was at primary school, our headmaster was an Anzac veteran, and we were told that the Turk was not to be trusted under any circumstances. It's become a story which has, in a sense, been loosened from its historical moorings and been given new values by people who I think are looking for people to admire and find something admirable in that willingness to go around halfway around the world and risk and give your life.
I find Anzac Day is personally really interesting because, you know, one of my grandfather fought for Australia in World War II, and I have a lot of the stories that he wrote and feel quite kind of devoted to what he did. And I'm unashamed to sort of say that, you know, I have a bit of a tear in my eye if I'm watching a dawn service or if I watch Gallipoli or so on. It really pulls certain strings. But at the same time, the little academic voice in my head is critiquing this nationalism. And so it was really interesting as an interviewer, as an academic interviewer, going and speaking to kids and teachers and hearing them talk about Anzac Day. And for many of them, it was an uncritical appreciation of Australian national identity, and it was really a belief in sort of having positive images of Australia and so on. And to sit there as an interviewer and feel slightly uncomfortable about certain things that were sort of said, like the sort of almost blind love of Gallipoli that some female students I spoke with showed, without really sort of thinking about the wider historical context and so on. But at the same time, it was really important to do that because it gave me an appreciation of the fact that these aren't simply political devices. They're deeply held personal views by people. And this is why the history wars are so contested, because people's attachment to their national past, which is a collective past, is paradoxically very personal.
I mean, I think that it's no coincidence, for example, that if you look at the debate around values in particular and the importance of history to national identity, post-September 11, you'll find in Britain, in Japan, in Germany, in Australia, in many, many countries, you will find an anxiety that in a way has been created by the uncertain international environment. So it's possible to see that in some ways this more conservative embrace of national history is itself a response to this increased international environment of threat and uncertainty.
But it's one of the paradoxes of our time, isn't it, that we live in an era of globalisation. The nation state carries less authority than it has at any time over the last 100 years. And there are various forms of compensation. The history wars arise from that very fact, I think, that the great historical transformations of our period, the freeing of the economy, free trade, have thrown great movements of people across borders in ways that have become very threatening. And to some extent, the history wars are a reaction against movement set in train by the very interests that fight the history wars.
You've been listening to Hindsight and the third program in the series History Under Siege. Join me, Michelle Rayner, next week for the final program in the series, when we travel to France to hear why the contemporary French Republic is still coming to terms with the legacies of its colonial past. And don't forget that you can find more information, images and audio on the series website.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.